share with you my story? Would you share your dollar with me?
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. Afternoon to you. This is John Williams. I'll be here until 1 o'clock. Anna DeVlantis is back these days. Good to hear her voice, and you will a little after 1 o'clock here on WGN Radio. John DeGerian joins us, the founder of MarketRebellion.com. This is a financial news, education, and subscription site. Visit MarketRebellion.com. And, John, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back. Thank you very much, John.
Let's start with stocks and sectors. What's on your radar this afternoon?
Well, with the new presidency just over a week away, I mean, it's the 12th today, so we're 8 days from President Biden being inaugurated. We know that he has a green energy outlook, both his cabinet and his supporters. So we've been really focused in on a lot of the green energy plays, like Fuel Cell, FCEL. That stock is exploding again today. Looking at stocks like Plug Power, PLUG, a lot of the Chinese EV stocks, because, again, it's not just Tesla that makes vehicles that people can afford that, you know, are mass-produced, although nobody makes as many vehicles as Tesla, of course, in the EV space. Nonetheless, there's a lot of Chinese competitors out there like NIO, N-I-O, like Li, L-I, and X-P-E-V. And it's not just vehicles that we drive, John, as you know. It's also vehicles that haul things, for instance, in warehouses and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of those have been, you know, LP gas driven. And I'm a big fan of LP gas, got no issue with that. But obviously getting it is a little dirtier in many cases. And so a lot of true EV plays are, I think, going to prosper in that arena as well. So not just consumers, not just over-the-road truckers either, but also in warehouses. And there's a lot more warehouses these days.
What's the status of Chinese-owned companies being listed publicly in America?
That is a great question, and one that I imagine President Biden will address through both actions and the sorts of people that he sets in charge of various agencies. Right now I'd say that there is not a prohibition and not an automatic delisting of certain members of that sect, but I think there are a lot of questions regarding the accounting standards and why they've been so lax for so long in that Chinese stocks of all shapes and colors, whether it's Alibaba or whether it's any of these Chinese EVs.
Oh, I see. So that's maybe not politics, maybe that's accounting. You're suggesting that if the Chinese companies are inaccurately reporting their value, say, then that's not that's not fairly traded on the stock exchange, and they won't have anything to do with that. Is that where you're going with this?
Yes. And it really comes down to, I think, that the generally accepted principles of accounting, that everybody else that's listed in the United States has to adhere to. For whatever reason, throughout history, this didn't just happen in this most recent administration. They've been lax on the Chinese as they more or less started to take baby steps and now much bigger steps into capitalism with the listing of these companies and so forth. And they haven't had the accounting oversight, the quarterly reporting, and many of the other things that are required for companies to be listed in the United States. And I think that is something that will likely change over time. I don't know how quickly, though, John.
John, this is interesting. Somebody I was following, just clicking around Twitter the other day, and they said, uh-oh, President Trump has taken over Governor Cuomo's Twitter account because Governor Cuomo, you know where I'm going with this, was tweeting that we have to reopen the economy. The price we're paying fighting the coronavirus on the medical front has been too great, and so we need to maybe take our lumps and open up the economy more. How noteworthy is that? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it is something that we have to do. And I know you're saying that tongue-in-cheek about the president taking over his account, but it is the message the president's been sending for quite a while. I'm glad that, you know, New York realizes that if they stay locked down for another 6 months until we get to that 70 or 80% number that Dr. Fauci and others have indicated we need to get to with the vaccinations, if we stay locked down that long, I don't know where the money comes from to save those cities, to save those states where it's like that. That's just, it's a bridge too far, it's too expensive, and there'll be a lot more pain. And so I do think that, you know, measured amounts of in-person dining and so forth are necessary if we want to let these businesses survive, John.
Yeah. State of Minnesota is opening restaurants back up to, I think, 50% as of yesterday, but also their infection rate is less than ours. But it will be interesting to see if other states and cities follow New York's lead. If nothing else, it'll be interesting to see what happens in New York. John Najarian is the founder of MarketRebellion.com. MarketRebellion.com. Let's talk next week, John. Nice to talk to you today.
I look forward to it every week. Thank you, John.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Tax attorney Stephen Leahy is on a phone line. Visit ChicagoTaxTeam.com. You hear him at various times on this radio station, including sometimes on Saturday mornings. Hey, Stephen, welcome back to WGN. How are you today?
I'm just great, John. Thanks for having me on. First, let me tell you, I love Executive Green Carpet Cleaning Company. They're just the best. I always wanted to tell you that.
You know, I we could go on about that, but let's not, except to say that I was looking at Google reviews, and some of the reviews are the kind of reviews that you would write if you were writing your own review, but it's customers who say they heard that commercial on WGN, and it's true. And I think that's true about just about all of our sponsors. They really are what they say they are. You say that 2021 is not going to be that different than 2020 from a tax obligation standpoint. Is that right?
That's right, except for this. You know, as we talk about people who are on unemployment that aren't used to it, right? Most people aren't used to collecting unemployment, and they don't really know how that works. And, you know, when they get a check from their employer and the employer takes out their taxes, and then they usually get a refund, right? And so, but this year, if you've been on unemployment, that's going to change for you. You're going to probably going to owe the IRS money because they don't take taxes out, and unemployment is taxable. So that's going to create a problem for people. Here's what you don't do if this is happening to you. You don't not file your tax return, right? So a lot of people, they're afraid they're going to owe the taxes, and so they don't do their tax returns. So that's the number one thing. Get your tax returns done. If you owe the IRS money, if you owe less than $10,000, you can just ask for a payment plan, and they'll give you a payment plan. You could pay it over 2 years and without any penalties. Well, I shouldn't say that. There's penalties and there's interest, but they're not going to come after you. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, right.
And so you could solve that problem, you know, pretty quickly over a period of time.
I guess we need the revenue nationally at the federal level, but it just makes no sense to me that if you're giving me money because I'm not making any money, I don't work, I have unemployment benefits coming, so then you're going to I already told you I don't have any money. Why are you taxing me? Give me less, for crying out loud, but don't tax me the following year.
Exactly. And, you know, it used to be that they didn't tax the unemployment, and it used to be they didn't tax Social Security. But, you know, now the federal government does. So, you know, they're always looking to get more money from us, and that's one of the ways they do it. But, and again, just be on alert that they don't take taxes out, and you're probably going to owe some money.
I wanted to ask you about the first thing you said, though. I mean, evidently there are changes that we need to pay attention to, and for many people, unemployment and filing is going to be a first-time issue for them. But the brackets have not changed then, right? So there's talk about that, but right now the brackets are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Standard deduction is the same, right?
That's correct.
Fewer people itemized last year because the Trump administration changed the tax code. I think to people's advantage, it was simpler and maybe more advantageous to people in some brackets. That hasn't changed, right?
That's right. And again, that's what, you know, you get more automatic deduction, so you don't have to go through and itemize them, and that makes you, first, it reduces your tax preparation fees, because you don't have to worry about the, you know, about itemizing everything. They just kind of give you more, and unless you go over that amount, and most people don't, you know, a vast majority of people never go over that amount, so it's been a benefit.
815 texted in to say, I'm working from home every other week. Is there a tax write-off available to me if I'm working from home?
If you're using your home for business purposes, yes, there is a tax write-off. And you, it, now, again, it goes back to this, what we were just talking about. Does it make sense to start itemizing, or are you getting, you know, are you going to create more problems? And there's obviously much more of a chance for you to get audited if you're taking business deductions and you're not in business for yourself, right? If I'm an employee, it becomes more complicated. Because this is where people cheat. And so if you go to some tax preparers and you get a great tax refund, all my friends got great tax refunds here. The reasons why they do that is because they falsify businesses. And a lot of people don't look at their tax return, so they don't even know that the tax preparer did that.
Sure.
To them.
All right, but answer me this. If I work for an employer who now has me working from home, and that spare bedroom is now my office, but I'm not self-employed, I'm working for somebody else, am I eligible for a deduction for that amount of square footage that I'm using?
Again, it's going to be on a case-by-case basis, but generally the answer is yes, right?
Yes.
Because you're using it for
business
purposes.
And then you would just prorate the amount of space that you're using relative to your household. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. That's how that works. Now, one more thing I wanted to point out to people, because this has just changed, and that's the PPP program, right, that was out last year. And one of the big changes that just came out with a new law, because now we have a new PPP program coming in, one of the things that they changed is now you can deduct the expenses that you use that money for. And that's big. You know, so I don't think, you know, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but under the last PPP program, if you used money for your rent, for instance, or for employees, that when you went to go deduct those expenses from your income, you couldn't do it because you didn't pay that money. The government did. But they changed that in this new law. And so now you can deduct it. It's going to be a big benefit for business owners.
About the unemployment benefits that people are getting, that's counted as simple income, right?
Yeah, it's just income.
But here's my question with that. So then say I didn't work hardly at all. What is the threshold that I have to achieve in order for me to start paying taxes? Like maybe I don't owe anything because my unemployment benefits were so low. My income was so low this year. I guess I'm asking how are the brackets structured?
I believe it starts at $13,000, but then it depends on what kind of income you're getting. If you're getting other kind of income too, you know, then that's not a hard and fast rule about where that money, that line is. So again, if I'm getting income from Social Security or, and then somewhere else, then I do have to file a tax return. Here's my advice to people anyway. If you think you don't have to file a tax return, still file a tax return. It's better to file the tax return because these you can get it done for free. If I'm making less than $40,000, you can get your tax return done for free. So instead of guessing whether I should have or shouldn't have, just do it. It's better. It starts a lot of the dates ticking. Mm-hmm. If I file the tax return, and then I don't ever have to look back and say, oh, I should have done that. You know, it's not that complicated if I don't make a lot of money, and it's free. So do it.
Who's doing it for free if I make less than $40,000?
There's all over the internet. I can provide that information to you, John. For
that's pretty simple
for your listeners.
Click, huh? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's the, you know, they you go on. There's a whole host of companies that will do it online for free.
Hmm. Is the stimulus taxable?
They are not taxing the stimulus.
Yeah, that's we asked and answered that a couple of days ago with somebody else, but I don't think we can ask and answer that question too often. So if you got $600 or $1,200, that is not counted as income, and you don't have to pay that back. That's a gift from the government, right?
Yes, it is, and it kind of goes back to what you were just saying. You know, they're giving me money, and then they're going to tax me on it. It's like, and that's what the whole PPP program was like. You're forgiving the loan, but then you're not letting me take the deduction, and it's like putting a tax on me for it. And it doesn't make any sense. But a lot of things our government does doesn't make any sense.
Well, on the unemployment side, a couple of listeners texted in to say that you do have the option on unemployment benefits to have taxes taken out at that time. I guess that would be the best option if you need the money, take the money and spend it, but then realize that you'll have to pay taxes on it if you didn't have the taxes taken out at first.
Exactly. And most people don't, though. You know, most people will not because they say, I need the money, right? And it's not all my income. So I'm taking a hit in my income, and so I need all that money. And who knew that it was going to last this long?
John, I had to sell stuff that I've owned for years on eBay and Craigslist this year to make ends meet. Do I have to pay taxes on the income I got from those sales?
The answer is you're really transferring assets into cash, right? So unless you made money on it, so I bought something for $5 and I sold it for $10, well, then the $5 is income, right? But if I just sell something, then the answer is no, I don't have to pay taxes on that.
I did not expect that. I did not expect that. I thought it was the opposite. That is, you've got utility out of it, and now if you're going to turn it into cash, you pay taxes. Not that anybody ever reported these sales, but...
Yeah, that's true.
But you don't.
But I pay taxes on the money that I used to buy it.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Well, so I already paid taxes on that money.
A minute left. What's the best or basic, what simple advice do you have for people planning their taxes for 2021?
Okay, so this is, and I'm going to go back to what I said at the beginning. File your tax return. People get afraid when they owe the IRS money and they don't file. So the first and foremost is file your tax return. And then let, if you owe them, work that out. So whatever you do, file it on time. That's my advice to everybody.
Stephen Leahy is a tax accountant or a tax attorney.
Attorney.
ChicagoTaxTeam.com. Visit ChicagoTaxTeam.com to find out more. Steve, well done. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, I appreciate him joining us. I think we're going to need to put him on about every day between now and the middle of the year. Maybe through the year. S&P up 3.54 points. The market's not too eventful today. It's a good day maybe to visit with Dale Buss and talk a little bit about flyover country. It's a topic that he's written about before and suddenly is, in a way, more relevant now than maybe ever. Visit flyovercoalition.org. Dale is the veteran financial journalist and the founder and executive director of that group, the Flyover Coalition. Hi, Dale. Welcome back.
Good afternoon. Thanks, John.
I'm interested in a piece that you all posted, the 40,000-foot view, and I just wanted to quote a line from it. America will have to progress on the local and regional levels where people actually live, whatever happens on the fractured plane of national identity and politics. You wrote a piece that says that right now we are reminded that we are very divided in this country, and maybe that puts more emphasis on shopping locally, and that includes investing in businesses where you live, like the Midwest, like flyover country. That's an interesting take.
Yeah, exactly. I'm calling it the new localism, maybe for lack of a better term. But the idea is, let's not talk about what's happening at the national level, as riveting as it is, as important as it is, as divisive as it is. Where we actually live, most of us, is not Washington, D.C. It's out here in Chicago and Omaha and Detroit and Des Moines and Little Rock. It's on the coast as well. But there's so much to be done on the local level, on the state level, to kind of repair our economy, to repair, let's say, relationships among people, and to just kind of bolster our way of life. That's kind of what I'm proposing that we focus on, and that we, especially in flyover country, we refocus on the advantages that we have out here. Things like our leadership in manufacturing, things like our leadership in helping companies kind of reconstitute their supply chains so they're less dependent on China. And then you look at the advantages that we have out here, as exemplified by the moves that companies are making out of Silicon Valley to go to places like Austin, tech companies that say, we're just not down with it anymore. The cost of living, the everything that's going on in a place like San Francisco, we want to go to the heartland, and we can do our tech stuff out here just as well. So I'm just kind of urging people, while obviously what's happening in national politics and everything is crucial, We live out here, and this is where we need to have our focus to try to rebuild in what is hopefully a post-COVID economy.
Yeah, right. And that's the driver maybe as much as anything, is it not, rather than the politics of the day. It's that if the pandemic is sending people out of the offices and home, and maybe from some homes in the cities to the suburbs, I guess that migration, that reverse migration could continue, couldn't it, all the way to Michigan and Wisconsin and Iowa and Illinois and Indiana.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it is happening already, and it's anecdotal at this point, but I'm sure there are already academics at Big Ten universities studying it. There's no doubt that there is a migration from the big cities on the coasts. Some of it's going to the suburbs and the exurbs of those various cities, but a lot of it is eyeing flyover country. And, you know, the dramatic example of some of these big Silicon Valley companies like Oracle and HP Enterprise literally having announced in the last few weeks, we're going to move our headquarters to Austin. They'll still have people in Silicon Valley, but they recognize, you know, maybe it's the attraction of a place like Austin that does have an established ecosystem, but it's also the lower cost of living, the amenities available, you know, in flyover country. And there's many things attracting companies, not just to Texas, but to places all over, mm-hmm. all over here. And I think that has a chance to be significant, and a lot of people do.
I wonder what cities that favors in the Midwest then. I'm not sure that Chicago is one, but maybe a Milwaukee, maybe even a Detroit or a St. Louis.
Right. I mean, Indianapolis is a good example. They have a very strong tech ecosystem there already. They've got a Salesforce, the big software company, has a huge presence in Indianapolis, and there are a number of other tech companies. So that's an example. But every city in flyover country has been eyeing the idea of establishing more of a tech ecosystem. They're all trying to do it. I mean, Chicago has huge advantages in that area because of the knowledge worker base. And so in an area like food technology with digital application, Chicago, you know, is and can be more of a leader. So it's opening up possibilities across the region as, you know, the coasts still kind of struggle with where they're going with all this. And the high cost of living there are obviously a huge hindrance.
Well, that's what I was thinking. And maybe Chicago is more competitive relative to San Francisco, but not much. I mean, Chicago is not an expensive place
sure.
to live, especially if you
yeah.
can go up the road and be in Milwaukee or down
yeah.
the road and go to Peoria for that matter. But let me ask you about this. I wonder when we talk about, though, this kind of migration, if the real decoupling that we should be thinking about or that might be happening is the U.S. and China. I wonder
yeah.
if the United States is finally going to say we need to start building things here again.
That is absolutely happening. So that's another huge strand of this story is that you know, early on in the pandemic, there was a lot of hostility toward China, as well as a feeling among manufacturers here that they were vulnerable, unlike they'd ever really recognized. You know, if China could shut down because of a pandemic or something else, where did that leave them trying to finish goods and get them to American consumers? So this whole notion of made in America and decoupling from China is really, really just starting to get traction, actually, because it takes manufacturers months and in some cases years to restructure their supply chains. You know, they have to be careful. They have to make sure the moves that they're making can be depended upon. So, you know, you've got a guy like David McNeil there at WeatherTech in Bolingbrook. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what his Super Bowl ad is going to be. But he, you know, really was in the vanguard of something that's picking up a lot of momentum. And I was talking to a CEO in the Twin Cities, Vicky Holt of Proto Labs. They do digital manufacturing. She said they are just starting to get lots of interest from companies and saying, help us take this part, this assembly, this component out of China. Let's help us move it to the U.S. or somewhere, maybe Mexico, somewhere less vulnerable. And this is really going to pick up, I think, a lot of momentum, not just in flyover country, but across the country. And we have a good chance as a region to benefit tremendously from that.
Flyovercoalition.org is the website, flyovercoalition.org. Dale Buss is there. Nice to talk to you, Dale. Let's visit again. I appreciate your time.
Thanks again, John.
The news continues on the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. There's a new unicorn in Chicago. Software startup Infusion has raised $150 million in new funding, pushing its valuation to $1.5 billion. The company makes investment management software. Chicago Inno says the minority investment comes from Iconic Growth, the tech-focused investment arm of the San Francisco-based Iconic Capital. A unicorn is a private startup valued at $1 billion or more. The historic Chicago snack company Vitner's is being sold again. The potato chip brand is being sold to Pennsylvania-based Utz Quality Foods. Vitner's was sold to Snack King in 2011. The C.J. Vitner Company was founded on Chicago's South Side in 1926 and started with just five shops. Utz will reportedly acquire Vitner's for $25 million. Utz plans to move manufacturing of most of Vitner's products to its own plants after the deal closes. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
WGN Radio News in 9 minutes. Let's spend those with Amy Guth and talk about what's going on the Mag Mile in Chicago. Welcome back, Amy. How are you?
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to mention, I know that Macy's is closing its Water Tower Place store, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we heard that news from Macy's. Gap had already announced that they're going to be closing their big store there on Michigan Mile, on the Mag Mile. But now today we've learned that Express is men's and women's clothing there. They're going to be closing their Mag Mile store as well. They still have a location at Water Tower Place and one on State Street. Those are staying for now. But that one on Mag Mile is going to close. So here's another retailer kind of joining this really, you know, this growing group of retailers that are just not able to sustain this bigger flagship store on such a, you know, premium piece of real estate. So I think there's going to be some questions for the Michigan Avenue, you know, retailers to be thinking of, and the Mag Mile Association to be really thinking of, hey, what do we want this to be and how will we fill these spaces? That's a big pain for commercial landlords that a lot of them are feeling right now that they were in the retail game. You know, this is part of a bigger strategy. They said they're going to be closing 100 stores in 3 years for Express. So we're going to see some other closures, but again, for now, the one at Water Tower and the one on State are going to stay open, but this big store in Michigan is going to be closing shortly.
Don't you suppose these stores will all come back, or those spaces will go back to premium retailers? I mean, that is what the Magnificent Mile is, and the COVID isn't going to be here forever. I can't imagine anything replacing those kinds of retail points or restaurants.
Yeah, some developers had kind of began to have started been thinking about, like, is it more experiential? Maybe we put in restaurants. Maybe we move the theater district to Michigan Avenue. You know, of course, then what do we put in the theater district? So, you know, I think there's a lot of questions of, okay, well, if it's not retail, what's it going to be? But I agree with you. I think, you know, it's been a retail corridor for so long and people know it. I mean, the sheer number of the millions of people that pass through that area in a given year, It's stunning. It's in the millions of people that count on that area for shopping and you know, use it for tourism and all that. And it plays such a big role in tourism dollars, too. So it's hard to imagine what it would be if it wasn't that big shopping district. But I think some people are starting to think that way. But are they thinking about it soon enough? You know, by the time the pandemic is over and people are more comfortable being outside in larger numbers, is that enough time to have reimagined it? That seems pretty ambitious. So there's kind of this interim of what happens in the meantime. Are there, you know, the Forever 21 space, what we saw happen there was they left the flagship location, but they're putting in two smaller stores. So is it a matter of maybe splitting up some locations into smaller stores while this kind of revamp is happening? Or is it simply that brick and mortar shopping, that appetite will come back, and so we just populate it with a lot of smaller stores? I think that's really the big question facing Michigan Avenue right now.
Walmart is going to deliver groceries, but they're going to deliver them to even cold food will be delivered to your door. How are they going to do that?
Yeah, I thought this was kind of interesting. I don't know how people feel about having a permanent cooler refrigerator situation on their front porch, but essentially that's what they're doing. They're calling this a smart cooler so that that you could have your groceries delivered and they would just put them right in the fridge so that, you know, anything that needed refrigeration wouldn't spoil sitting out on the porch in this contactless delivery way. So they're going to test this. They're going to do this around their HQ in Arkansas and see how it goes and kind of see what happens. But it's an interesting idea of being able to, you know, order something. And it's not just shelf-stable goods like cereal and crackers. It could be, you know, things like, you know, chicken or cheese or something like that that would need refrigeration. And, it, you know, they could put it right there in the fridge on your front porch. Apparently it will have some kind of, you know, a contact code to, so that you could, someone could just walk up and take your groceries off of your fridge or off of your front porch fridge rather. But I think that'll be interesting to monitor and see what that's going to look like and how that's going to go with these, you know, smart fridge. I think the brand they're calling is the Home Valet, of what all that would mean for delivery. But to me, kind of pulling back a little bit, this is a bigger piece of this ongoing battle between Walmart and Amazon. When Walmart really first kind of let it be known they wanted to take on Amazon, that seemed kind of far-fetched. That seemed, you know, Walmart's already kind of known for one thing, these big box stores that have kind of everything. But they've really done a lot in a relatively short amount of time, offering Walmart Plus to compete with Amazon Prime. Now this, you know, they keep kind of moving the needle and they've caught up with Amazon relatively quickly. So I think it's going to be really interesting to keep monitoring the quarterly earnings of both companies and the moves, the innovation moves from each company to see how they keep kind of one-upping each other to try to get some customer loyalty.
Just 30 seconds left, Amy, but what's the other headline on Walmart and Robinhood today?
Yeah, so Walmart is also going to create a financial tech startup with Ribbit Capital, which is one of the investment firms behind Robinhood, which is a very popular finance app, to create financial products at a lower price point for Walmart workers and customers. So we don't know a ton about what this will look like, but the CEO was talking about in a statement, kind of talking about, hey, they people depend on us to save money in their shopping. Now let's expand that and go further with that. So it'll be interesting to see what this product looks like, that this Walmart financial product, and how that's going to roll out to the market.
That's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.